The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots and lots to get to on this beautiful morning here on the Edmond campus. Keep passing the little cluster of deer that we have roaming the campus. I've seen three together quite often, and then four a few times the last few days. This morning, right outside our beautiful MPC facility, five deer, including the male deer, as they were spooked by me coming down the gravel road. So beautiful creatures, and so many wonderful, lots of growth and development on campus. Of course, the campus is as beautiful as ever, and we're seeing more and more animals roaming these beautiful fields as well, just like at Edstone as well. So we certainly are blessed to be in such a peaceful environment. I thought I'd begin by just updating you from one of our listeners down in the Bahamas. The Bahamas, of course, has taken the worst of it as far as Hurricane Dorian is concerned. And this comes from one of our listeners who said that, thank God that because of his protection, the brethren here are all safe. Says the islands hit were about 100 plus miles to the north and west of us. The misery is just beginning as residents deal with the aftermath. From all the pictures and videos, this was, as advertised, a powerful, dangerous, and destructive storm. There is really not much defense against a storm this powerful when you are in a relatively low-lying area surrounded by water. He says here that the brethren living in the capital have experienced some high winds and rain, along with flooding in some areas and some power outages. I have no update from the brethren in Exuma, which is 140 miles south. But seeing that the storm steered clear of those islands, they escaped the fury of this violent and record-setting storm. So it looks like the brethren that we have down there, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but most of them were out of the, at least out of the worst of the hit there in the Bahamas. So that's very good news for God's people living in the Bahamas. Well, how many times have we had a Trumpet magazine come out with an impressive cover, an eye-catching cover, like this one that was just put on my table just today, or I guess yesterday? Britain's Trump. It's got a painting of Boris Johnson by our very own Gary Dorning. And again, an article there from Richard Palmer, which we've discussed some of the content in recent weeks because it was produced several weeks ago. But then you look at what's happening in the UK today. It's just, as we've been saying, you don't just have the similarities between the leader of the United States and the leader of the UK, but you have a very similar attack on both of them as well. Yesterday's vote that got quite a lot of news, at least in the UK last night, not nearly enough in the US. Hardly anything on the networks. I was happy to at least see a pretty lengthy article in the New York Times this morning. But of course, they're cheerleading for those forces working against the Prime Minister in the UK. But here they vote last night in the UK to essentially throw out the normal parliamentary convention. It's the government that controls the timetable and the activities in the House. And last night that was flipped on its head. Richard sent in some thoughts. He's on vacation this week, as it happens. And yet he's been, as if you got your Trumpet brief last night, you can see that he's putting in a little bit of work while on vacation, with all that's happening in the UK. But he sent a few more thoughts this morning, saying that yesterday that vote to take control of the timetable of the House went through. So today, Parliament is fast-tracking through a surrender bill. This bill would mean Britain would couldn't leave the EU without a deal. That's what these anti-Brexit forces want. They don't want Boris Johnson to have any leverage. I mean, Boris Johnson wants some kind of a deal with the EU, but he's always maintained that if there's no deal by October 31st, then we're out. It's a clean break. And so here come these anti-Brexit forces saying, no, you can't leave with no deal. You have to make a deal. And it just pretty much takes away all the leverage that Boris Johnson has with the EU to try to make a deal. Of course, the bureaucrats in the EU are sitting back and rubbing their hands. Well, this is great. If this is what Parliament does, then we've got them over a barrel. Richard said there's a couple of efforts now underway to stop the surrender bill. We'll learn later today whether or not that goes through. It probably will. But it's similar to the U.S. where you've got the House and then you've got the Senate. They've got the House of Commons over there trying to work through this bill, but then it has to be approved by the House of Lords. And there's plenty of anti-Brexit forces in the House of Lords as well, but there's also ones who are very much supportive of the Prime Minister, who are talking about filibustering it, delaying it just long enough. We're coming up to, I think it's just, 50-some days? And then the House or Parliament's about to go into recess. I think September the 9th is the date for that. So it's coming right down to the wire, and that's why there's all these acts of desperation from Richard's trumpet brief last night. He wrote about this showdown and Boris Johnson, of course, coming out last week, calling on the Queen to suspend Parliament, which she did. So September 9th is the recess, and then it continues through to the 14th of October. And then October 31st, of course, is the deadline. Richard says, but pro-EU fanatics in Parliament are not going quietly into that good night. It says, rejecting all precedent, Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, is allowing Parliament to take control of the legislative schedule. He's paving the way for Parliament to rush through a new law that would stop Brexit, dubbed the Surrender Bill. That's what Boris Johnson's calling it. He's saying, look, you're just forcing us to surrender. That's what you want. You want us to surrender to the EU. It says the law would try to force the government to stay in the EU unless Parliament approves a new deal. Richard says it appears as though this is the climax of the Brexit battle. One side wants to respect the result of the 2016 referendum and get Britain out of the EU. The other wants to ignore the will of the people and get as close to keeping Britain in the EU as possible. This climax is exposing the extreme lengths the pro-Brexit forces are willing to go. That's what this is exposing. All those voices from the radical left last week, incredibly, when Boris Johnson was calling for a recess of all things, they were accusing him of a coup. It's exactly the opposite. The coup's going on this week. They're throwing caution to the wind, those in the radical left. Melanie Phillips had a piece just this morning, Prime Minister taken hostage in Britain's Brexit civil war. It is a civil war. Politically speaking, it's a civil war, and they're trying to take the Prime Minister hostage. Melanie Phillips says the hypocrisy is stunning. These MPs are voting to thwart legislation they themselves have passed. It's like we played yesterday from Jacob Rees-Mogg. The law's already there. It's gone through multiple times. Laws that they themselves have passed. The House, the Parliament. Melanie says they're doing so under the preposterous pretense that they are defending the historic rights of Parliament against the government. She says, in reality, they're destroying the historic constitutional balance between government and Parliament. They're destroying the balance. So just to give you a little bit of the background as to what happened yesterday, I think the New York Times, if you strip aside the left-wing commentary throughout, it does summarize some of the events for some of our non-UK listeners. It's always a little bit of a challenge. That's why we need Richard so much. It's always a bit of a challenge to just understand the way that the government works in the UK. But you have these lawmakers yesterday rising up against the Prime Minister, trying to prevent him from taking Britain out of the EU without some kind of a formal agreement. That's what's behind this showdown. It says, a little over a month ago, this is the New York Times now, Mr. Johnson, a brash, blustery politician often compared to President Trump. That's what we have on our cover of the recent magazine, the Trumpet magazine. It says he swept into office with a vow to finally wrest Britain from the European Union by whatever means necessary, even if it meant a disorderly no-deal departure. Well, that's the Times' opinion. Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters, they're there saying, if we leave with no deal, this is going to be catastrophic. People are going to starve. We're going to have a shortage in fuel and all these other things. It says now Parliament has pulled the rug out from under him, and Mr. Johnson is at risk of falling into the same Brexit quagmire that dragged down the predecessor as Prime Minister Theresa May. They're calling it the same Brexit quagmire. Really, there's nothing that complicated about it. The people 3 years ago voted to leave. They didn't have this vote saying, well, we want to leave with this kind of a deal or that kind of a deal, or it has to be with this, this, and this, and this. They voted to exit. They voted to depart. And for 3 years, the British deep state, if you want to call it that, has been hard at work trying to stop this from happening. That's the backstory to what we saw happen yesterday. The Times says the lawmakers forced his hand by voting 328 to 301 to take control of Parliament away from the government and vote on legislation as soon as Wednesday, that's today, that would block the Prime Minister from making good on his threat of a no-deal Brexit. And that's what prompted the angry response from Boris Johnson last night in the House of Commons. Here's clip 7.
There be no doubt, Mr. Speaker, about the consequences of this vote tonight. It means that Parliament is on the brink of wrecking any deal that we might be able to strike in Brussels, because tomorrow's bill would hand control of the negotiations to the EU, and that would mean more dither, more delay, and more confusion. And it would mean that the EU themselves would be able to decide how long to keep this country in the EU. And since I refuse to go along with that plan, we are going to have to make a choice, Mr. Speaker. I don't want an election. The public don't want an election. I don't believe the Right Honourable Gentleman wants an election. But if the House votes for this bill tomorrow, the public will have to choose who goes to Brussels on October the 17th to sort this out and take this country forward.
And so Mr. Johnson there is saying, if that's what you're going to do today, then we need to have general elections in mid-October. We need to, which would essentially be another Brexit referendum. And incredibly, Jeremy Corbyn, who's been calling for general elections for the past 2 years, has said, no, we don't want that. Because they know. They know an election that's based on Brexit alone, the Conservatives are most likely going to win. In fact, there was a piece in The Spectator today. Of course, all in the left-wing media, they're saying that this is huge, that this is quite a setback for Boris Johnson. He's, well, even Melanie Phillips says they're trying to take him hostage. But at The Spectator, I forget the, I didn't write down the columnist, but he wonders if Corbyn, not Boris, is the real loser from last night. Because if it's moving forward toward a general election in mid-October, and you can see again why the radical left doesn't want that, but if that's how this ends up, then you've got another referendum. Now, we don't know exactly how all these things are going to play out when it comes to the majority or the people voting. But there are things, there still are things that Boris Johnson can do. And he's fighting back those conservatives that flipped sides last night to vote with the Remainers. He booted them out of the party. So he's taking some aggressive action. He's standing up. It is a similar storyline in many ways to what's happening in the United States. It says here in the New York Times, on Tuesday night, Downing Street began pressing ahead with plans to discipline those rebels who voted against the government, moving to expel them from the Conservative Party. And then it mentions some of those expelled, including Nicholas Soames, the grandson of Winston Churchill. A bit of a disappointment there, particularly with what we're going through in the Churchill class. The Times says here, opponents of a no-deal Brexit argue that leaving the bloc without a deal, as Mr. Johnson has promised to do if no agreement is reached, would be catastrophic for the British economy. Many experts say, this is the New York Times referring to many experts. It sounds like what they talk about with respect to climate change. Well, look, all the experts believe this. The experts are always right. Many experts, don't you know? They say that it could lead to shortages of food, fuel, and medicine and wreak havoc on parts of the manufacturing sector that rely on the scamless flow of goods across the English Channel. And the conservatives are like, if that's what you believe, fine. Let it go through. Make a clean break. And then if all of that happens, you can be swept into power. You'd easily win a general election. Scaremongering, that's what's happening. It says Mr. Johnson says he needs to keep the no-deal option on the table to give him leverage in talks in Brussels. The Prime Minister appealed to his own lawmakers not to support what he called Jeremy Corbyn's surrender bill. It's a surrender bill. You look at the track record, you judge by fruits, as Jesus said that we should, and you know what's driving it, you know what's motivating it. They want to surrender to the EU. Well, they don't want to leave in the first place. But the people do. And so 3 years of this fighting. And as Richard said in his trumpet brief last night, they're not going down easy. They're pulling out all the stops. They've taken control of Parliament away from the government of all things. Melanie Phillips says, the chasm between the Remainers and the Brexiteers is now the overriding division in British politics. This is the worst constitutional and political crisis, at least since the Corn Laws, if I'm reading that right, split the Tories in the 19th century and arguably since the 17th century English Civil War. She says that Civil War involved Parliament's battle against the Crown, at the bloody end of which the British parliamentary settlement was sealed, enshrining the ultimate sovereignty of the people. Now the settlement has been upended by Remainer MPs who have set Parliament itself against the people, with the government representing the will of the people at war with Parliament. She says we're now shockingly deep into totally uncharted territory. We're deep into it. Uncharted territory. And the parallels that are there with what's happening there in the UK and what's happening here in the United States. We'll talk more about the US coming up in the next segment. But the parallels are striking. the radical left's war against Boris Johnson, against Brexit, against the United States, against the Trump administration. Richard wrote last night in the brief, these parallels mean that understanding the situation in Britain is important for everyone around the world. Boris Johnson's actions to uphold the people's vote have been entirely in line with Britain's constitution. And then he talks about the prorogue or the suspension or the recess that he called for last week and how that this is entirely normal. Every prime minister does it. It always happens at this time of year as well. Pretty amazing. But he calls for the recess and the anti-Brexiteers, they immediately go crazy. They immediately start shouting him down. They immediately say he's heading up a coup. It's a constitutional crisis. In fact, the constitutional crisis is happening right now. The real constitutional crisis, as Richard said last night in the Trumpet brief, it says this brings us to today's showdown, Richard's writing last night in the Trumpet brief. Under the UK's constitution, the ruling party controls Parliament's timetable. Well, we talked about some of this backstory and Johnson calling this a surrender bill from Jeremy Corbyn. It says 3 years ago, Britain voted to leave the European Union. In the wake of the referendum, Parliament also voted to leave. So the people voted for it, and then Parliament voted for it. It's like, I think it was Melanie Phillips, was it? One of the quotes I gave you a moment ago, where she says, they're going against their own votes. They're going against their own laws that they've passed already. It says here, well, he quotes, actually, Trump, the Richard in the Trumpet brief quotes from Brad McDonald's piece from earlier this year, Brexit and Britain's Deep State. Maybe I can switch over to that because I've got a few excerpts from that as well. Let me just play first, though. This is Nigel Farage. He's his party, the Brexit Party, they're even further to the right of Boris Johnson. And here's, after all that happened yesterday, here's what he had to say in response, clip six.
Tonight, it's a slightly different me. We are in for the fight of our lives. We may find ourselves in a few weeks with no Brexit and with no chance in a general election to do anything about it. I fear that we are headed rapidly towards a very, very dark place. It's been going on gradually since 2016. You see, democracy only works if you have the principle of loser's consent. There will be millions of people out there who voted Brexit, who are great patriots, who are in danger of being beaten down by the other side. Well, what we did in that six-week campaign of the European elections is we managed to turn the hope and despair that existed in this country, we managed to turn it into hope and optimism.
And his party is gaining in popularity, the Brexit Party. And, of course, all the liberal outlets are highlighting the differences between the Brexit Party and Boris Johnson's Conservatives. But they're just as deeply divided, if not more so, in the liberal wing. There's division, deep divisions, all throughout. But with respect to Brexit, this is from Brad McDonald's piece in June, Brexit and Britain's deep state. He said 3 years have passed and Britain hasn't budged. In that time, Brexit has taken out two prime ministers, lobotomized the nation's two largest political parties, and paralyzed the political system with division, dysfunction, and scandal. Division, dysfunction, and scandal. What? Why hasn't Britain left the EU? He asked. 3 years. The people voted. Parliament passed legislation. He says one thing is evident. since June 2016, that's when Brexit, the vote, happened, an alliance of government agencies, corrupt politicians and bureaucrats, and the mainstream media have worked surreptitiously to prevent Brexit. Britain has a deep state that is passionately committed to rejecting the democratic mandate of the British people and keeping the nation wedded to the European Union. That's the goal. That's the aim here. And then he talks about the real coup. Nigel Farage says we're in a very dark place. Melanie Phillips says the prime minister is taken hostage in Britain's Brexit civil war. Mr. McDonald said in his piece, the past 3 years have furnished an enormous volume of evidence proving that both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have large, and the Conservative Party. It was the Conservatives who broke away last night to give the Liberals a majority, saying we have to have a deal. We can't have a clean break. We have to have a deal. A volume of evidence proving that both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have large contingents that supply that simply do not want Brexit. It says many politicians talk about accomplishing the will of the people and leaving the EU, but they are infused with the spirit of the deep state and refuse to take action to uphold the rule of law and democracy. Well, the one thing that we could say in conclusion here, we've talked about the temporary resurgence. Here we're battling in the United States and the UK from within this attack on our founding institutions. And God's word says that there's a temporary resurgence for the sake of his work. And so in the short run, that would seem to give Prime Minister Johnson some options. We'll certainly keep our eyes glued to what's coming out of the UK here in the next several weeks. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
Trumpet Daily. Richard wrote in his his trumpet brief last night. I think this is him, or he might be quoting from my father. But he said an evil force is trying to bring down Britain and America. If you believe the Bible is the word of God, then you cannot deny that there is a devil. And you cannot deny that Britain and America have been blessed by God. The devil's working against those blessings to bring down our nations. That's the goal. That's the objective, to bring down our nations. And you see the devil hard at work in the UK, and of course he's been hard at work here in the United States as well. Last week, Inspector General Michael Horowitz, in his report on Thursday, he said that Jim Comey set a dangerous example for the over 35,000 current FBI employees. A dangerous example. This is another story. I know I've talked about it repeatedly in the last several programs, but it hasn't gotten nearly enough coverage, especially when you consider what the report revealed. Of course, Jim Comey made a big deal out of the fact that there's no indictment. So he was high-fiving everyone on Twitter. But when you consider what that 80-page report revealed, well, for one, he says, the inspector general did, that Comey set a dangerous example. This report found that Comey's retention, this is a quote, handling and dissemination of certain memos violated department and FBI policies and his FBI employment agreement. Comey, as we know, he through his lawyers, he leaked the content of some of those memos to the New York Times. And he did that, as he admitted, in order to trigger a special counsel investigation. You go back to May 16th, 2017, the New York Times. After receiving the leak, the editorial board asked, did Mr. Trump obstruct justice? That's what Comey wanted. He wanted to put it out there and say, hey, I think he's obstructing justice. And the New York Times was happy to take his propaganda and run with it. That was May 16th, 2017. And wouldn't you know, the next day, May 17th, Rod Rosenstein appoints Robert Mueller III as special counsel. Now, after all of that, Comey came out and said, well, these memos, they were just my personal recordings, my personal interactions with the president. And I felt like the world needed to hear about those. This is what the IG said about that last week. Comey's characterization of the memos as personal records finds no support in the law and is wholly incompatible with the plain language of the statutes, regulations, and policies defining federal records and the terms of Comey's FBI employment agreement. The inspector general went on to say Comey's own personal conception of what was necessary was not an appropriate basis for ignoring the policies and agreements governing the use of FBI records. And then when you think of the hypocrisy, what was it that Melanie Phillips said? The hypocrisy on display in the UK? It's the same thing. Comey, there's one of the memos. This was after a dinner that he had with President Trump, just a week or so after he was inaugurated. He had the January 6th meeting, of course. That was just Comey and the president, or the president-elect. And then he had dinner with President Trump at the White House on January 28th, I think it was, 2017. And the memo that Comey produced following that meeting, he said in the memo, I explained to the president that he could count on me to always tell him the truth. He had just lied to him on January the 6th saying that you're not under investigation, when he was. But he says in this memo, I told the president he could always count on me to tell the truth. I said I don't do sneaky things. I don't leak. I don't do weasel moves. That's what he said in memo number two. I don't leak. And the whole reason he was writing these memos was so that he could leak them later. It's kind of like James Clapper, who came out after he leaked the discussion or the contents of that meeting from January 6, 2017. He went and leaked it to CNN. And then after it was made known across the news media, Clapper came out with an official statement saying, "I'm just dismayed. I can't understand how that this was leaked." And he was the leaker. These are the kinds of individuals that the administration in the U.S. is fighting constantly, nonstop. Comey loves his deep state, and he hates President Donald Trump. The IG report said, Comey said he was compelled to take these actions. If I love this country, this is quoting Comey, and I love the Department of Justice, and I love the FBI. The IG said, however, were a current or former FBI employees to follow the former director's example and disclose sensitive information in service of their own strongly held personal convictions, the FBI would be unable to dispatch its law enforcement duties properly. Why, if we did everything the way Comey did, if the 35,000 employees did it the way Comey did, we couldn't even function. The IG report said, in a country built on the rule of law, it is of utmost importance that all FBI employees adhere to department and FBI policies, particularly when confronted by what appear to be extraordinary circumstances or compelling personal convictions. All of this in the Inspector General's report. And yet still, Comey takes to Twitter and says people owe him an apology. That was the leader of the FBI for how many ever years? I forget how many years he was at the head of that department. But I just want to take you back to this crucial transition period from the presidential election in November of 2016 through to the inauguration, really that period in December and January leading up to President Trump's inauguration. The meeting, of course, you had President Obama and all of his intel officials following this intelligence assessment that determined that Russia, in fact, did meddle in the election from 2016, and they did help Donald Trump. That was what they found out in this accelerated pace that they put on this intel community to come up with this assessment. They had to do it within weeks so that Obama could set the stage for the deep state to be able to investigate the Trump administration even into his presidency. While they were doing whatever they wanted while he was president-elect, while he was just out there campaigning, spying, following, sending informants. Jeff Carlson at the Epoch Times, he said, FBI Director Jim Comey's first meeting with then-president-elect Donald Trump appears to have been part of the agency's counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign. Now, we've made this point this week already, but it's important to reiterate on this point here, because if you go back to testimony from Jim Comey, he talks about the briefing. That's what they refer to it as, a briefing on January the 6th with President-elect Trump as being sort of a defensive briefing. Well, we're just trying to help the president. We wanted him to know about this salacious gossip that was out there and that the media were about to run with it. Listen to what Jim Comey testified on June 8th, 2017 about this June 6th, or rather this January 6th meeting that he had had with President Trump. This is, or President-elect Trump. This is clip one.
I didn't want him thinking that I was briefing him on this to sort of hang it over him in some way. I was briefing him on it because we had been told by the media it was about to launch, We don't want to be keeping that from him. And if there was some, he needed to know this was being said. But I was very keen not to leave him with an impression that the Bureau was trying to do something to him. And so that's the context in which I said, sir, we're not personally investigating you.
So just that one quote alone, he says, we had been told by the media it was about to launch. In fact, it was James Clapper who launched it to CNN. And then he says, this was the context that I told him, we're not personally investigating you. In fact, they were, as we now know from the IG report. This is just one statement. And he's saying, look, it was just meant to be a kind of a defensive briefing from the IG report. Comey told Horowitz that the information that he was obtaining from this conversation he had with President-elect Trump ought to be treated like FISA-derived information or information in a counterintelligence investigation. In other words, this was not just a briefing. This was not just to update the president about what was happening. This was not to just tell him about the intelligence assessment or even the dossier. This was an intelligence gathering operation. And we know this now because the IG report says they had the secure laptop in the car so that as soon as Comey left the meeting, he immediately started typing memo number one. Pretty amazing. The Epic Times piece says, prior to the meeting with Trump at Trump Tower, Comey met with FBI officials involved in the Crossfire Hurricane investigation into the Trump campaign to discuss a strategy to obtain information. Listen, to discuss a strategy to obtain information on how to memorialize this meeting right after. They wanted to memorialize it. According to the IG report, there's several FBI witnesses that said the meeting was intended in part to see how President-elect Trump reacted to the allegations and whether he would reveal new information. This is from the IG report last week. Before, 2 years ago, it was, hey, you're not being investigated. We're just here to tell you that the media is about to run with this story, and we just thought you should know the more salacious details. But now, look at what the IG report has since revealed. They were gathering new information. They were seeking out new information. And then, as we know from Comey, even in his testimony before the congressional committee, the leaking of the memos, all of that was designed to trigger an investigation, a special counsel. This is from the IG report. It says, Comey outlined to the IG details of the meeting that took place between only himself and Trump. So here's the quote. At the conclusion of our session, Chief of Staff Priebus asked whether there is anything we haven't mentioned that they should know or that might come out. And I said there was something that Clapper wanted me to speak to the president-elect about alone or in a very small group. So Clapper wanted Comey to talk to President-elect Trump alone, which in itself is a little fishy. And they did end up alone. And it was Comey who came out with the memo right away. It says, I then executed the session exactly as I had planned. I told him, President Trump, or President-elect, that I wanted to meet with him to tell him more about what is in the reports. I said that the written reports themselves were, and then something's redacted, and the content known at IC senior level, and that I didn't want him caught cold by some of the detail. I said that the Russians allegedly had tapes. So he went into, again, the salacious details of what happened in the presidential suite at the Ritz-Carlton and so on. But if you look back at that, and what was written in the memo, he only covered the salacious details, the part about the prostitutes and the hotel room and so on. Now, listen to this exchange that Comey had with Jake Tapper. This is from April of 2018 when he was out on tour promoting his book, A Higher Loyalty, as it's called. This is a clip two.
In January 2017, when you met with President Trump and you did that oral presentation of what's in that two-page memo summarizing the Steele dossier, we know from the book that you talked about these unverified allegations involving him and prostitutes. Did you brief him about any of the other things in the Steele dossier, claims that his associates, Michael Cohen or Paul Manafort, were potentially working with the Russians, or was it only about the prostitutes?
It was only about the salacious part of it.
Why? Why only about that?
Because that was the part that the leaders of the intelligence community agreed he needed to be told about, because we knew it and thought it was about to become public. And if it was true, we didn't know whether it was true, it would be important to let him know this as part of a defensive briefing.
It's just a defensive briefing. And we knew this was about to come out. We thought it was about to go public. Keep in mind, Clapper's the one that took it public. Now, I'm not saying nobody in the media knew anything about the Steele dossier, but they knew enough not to report it, because it was all just hearsay. It was all just made up. It couldn't be verified. But they had to have the meeting and they had to have the briefing with the president in order for the media to have the hook to run with it. And then James Clapper made sure that that happened. But listen to that exchange. Tapper says, did you brief him about any of the other things in the Steele dossier? Like the fact that it says there Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort might have been working for the Russians. Now, you would think if they're going in as a defensive posture just to help the president-elect, you would think that he would say, you know what, Mr. President, I don't know if it's true, but you might keep your eye on Cohen and Manafort because they could be Russian agents. But no, nothing about that. Only about the prostitutes and such, and the fact that Vladimir Putin might have a video that he might blackmail you and that the media is about to run with this. Listen to this panel. We've played some of these clips before. This would be CNN reporting now, because it's been discussed between Comey and the president-elect on January the 6th. Here's CNN on January the 10th, 2017, clip 3.
This two-page synopsis that we're referring to, this is an annex. This is an addendum to the intelligence community report.
That's exactly right. There was a broader report that spoke to the intelligence community's assessment that Russia hacked the U.S. election, interfered in the U.S. election, and also had an intent in doing so. This two-page addendum was included in the documents for this briefing, but it was not part of that larger assessment on Russian interference.
So this is the breaking story. And what's almost farcical about it, as that Epoch Times piece brings out, is that it was Clapper who leaked it to James Tapper. And then, of course, they're approaching it. This is breaking news. This is about the two-page addendum. The president-elect was briefed on it. Here's the same panel as they continue to discuss the subject, clip 4.
The synopsis was considered so sensitive, it was not included in the classified report about Russian hacking that was more broadly distributed in Washington, but rather in an annex that was only shared at the most senior levels of government, that is, the current president, President Obama, the president-elect, Mr. Trump, and those 8 congressional leaders, Jake. So just to highlight the point there, you now have the intelligence community
right. In
possession of these documents and at least taking a look at them. You have the FBI, as Evan has reported, taking a look at them, and those senior congressional leaders. They have not established the veracity, but they are taking a look.
Now, when James Clapper was asked about these leaks that led to those reports, he was shocked. He said he was, I think in his words, I expressed to the president-elect my profound dismay at the leaks that have been appearing in the press. He talked about how extremely corrosive this is, how damaging it is to our national security. That was his official statement on January the 11th. And later on in the story, later on in the timeline, he admitted that he not only leaked it to Jake Tapper, but he leaked it to other news sources as well, other news agencies. CNN, after they ran with it, then BuzzFeed comes out and publishes all the contents of the Steele dossier. And there you have it. The narrative is off and running. President Trump's working with all of these Russian agents, and he himself is compromised because of the video. Andy McCarthy. I mentioned this briefly. I didn't have time to talk about it yesterday or quote from it. But he refers to this term, recollection recorded. That was the tell, McCarthy said the other day, in June 2017, when the existence of former Director Comey's memos first emerged, he was asked why he made them. Now listen to this June 2017 testimony. Why did Jim Comey make these memos? Here's clip five.
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the president. As a private citizen, I felt free to share that. I thought it very important to get it out.
He understood this to be my recollection recorded, he said there in his testimony. Now, McCarthy says in his piece, as any trial lawyer can tell you, recollection recorded is not an idle phrase. Most out-of-court statements, a news story about an event, are inadmissible in court as hearsay, but under some circumstances, recollection recorded is an exception to the hearsay rule. To qualify, the recollections must be recorded, such as in a memo, at the time of the incident, at the time the incident was fresh in the witness's memory, so that it accurately reflects the witness's knowledge. That's why, if you're not only an FBI official but a seasoned trial lawyer, such as Jim Comey, you'd want to write it down contemporaneously or immediately after the relevant event, perhaps in a car, speeding to a meeting with fellow investigators to report back to them about the investigation you've just done, despite telling your prime suspect, the incoming president, that you are not investigating him. McCarthy says, thanks to the IG report, we now know more of the gory details. The Obama administration launched an investigation in which the target was Donald Trump, and the objective was short-circuiting his presidency. I was able to read that last part on yesterday's program, but I just wanted to spend a little bit more time on this statement. Recollection recorded. These are sharp lawyers. And never mind what he said in memo two. He is sneaky. He is a leaker. He is a liar. All these things have been confirmed one way or another. And we've only got the tip of the iceberg with just one of potentially four reports or investigations. All this revealed and more just in the last week or so. You put it all together with what's happening right now in the UK. As my father wrote last year, we're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power and stay in power. They will do anything to stay in power. They will do anything to take down an administration, a politician, a leader, anyone who would stand up for law and order. Comey presents himself as someone who's above the law. He's above the fray. He's got the higher loyalty, so he says in his book. In fact, he's out there as lawless as any of them, undermining the Constitution, lying, leaking, sneaking. My father wrote, had Hillary Clinton been elected, the destructive trends that unfolded during the Obama presidency would have continued unchecked, and they surely would have intensified. As it is, with Donald Trump winning the election in 2016, so much of this evil, the fight isn't over, the war continues, but so much of the evil, at least, is being exposed. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That's all that we have time for on today's program, but if you join us again on the broadcast tomorrow, we'll have plenty more to get into. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.